Welcome, Parish Orphans and Retrogrades, to a special presentation of the show today, one where I admittedly make the claim from the outset that I am not home in Mississippi. I am, at this very minute, at this very hour, beginning to march peaceably on Washington, D.C. with the Stop the Steal rally on behalf of President Trump. You will see a follow-up interview with Michael Anton of Claremont Review, and I think you'll enjoy it. He's kind of the prognosticator excepcional for this election year, and he wrote The Coming Coup, and he wrote it 2 months before the election. I interviewed him a week before the election. He said what was going to happen. He's being humble in the interview you're about to see, and part of it is I think he's just getting a lot of heat from his Washington, D.C. colleagues. But he really called it. Read The Coming Coup. Look at the things that he says. Weigh his and apprise his claims and see what you think. As of right now, though, those of us who know the truth are marching in Washington, D.C. right now, so I won't be in the chat. Let's see it go right this hour, noon Eastern time on Saturday. I give you Mr. Michael Anton right now, and I'm in Washington, D.C.
Welcome, Parish Orphans and Retrogrades, to Rules for Retrogrades. I bring you today a special reprise show, another conversation with Mr. Michael Anton, who is a distinguished guest who came on and joined me a week before the election about his article, The Coming Coup, which he wrote 2 months before the election. It's all come to pass in precisely the way that he said it would. So I wanted to have him back. Mike, thanks, Michael. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
You come away from all this, no matter what happens, however bad for the fate of the country, all of what has come to pass will mean, you come away looking like you have a lot of credibility, and you seem to be a really humble guy. And you're just saying, well, this is just what they told me. I just reported on it, particularly with the follow-up article. The Coming Coup is your original one. The follow-up one was From Death Threats to Lies on the American Mind. We'll link them both again. And you've written one since then. But nevertheless, you have a lot of credibility. I read these articles to my wife the other night, and particularly the Coming Coup article from September the 4th on the American Mind. She kept stopping me. I read her, a week after the election. She's like, wait, this is the one you've been talking about? You're not adding details that actually came to pass to this? Because that's just everything that happened, particularly the ballot box stuff. Isn't it crazy that you're right from your own perspective? Sometimes it's crazy.
Well, we don't know that I'm right, for one thing. And second of all, you could say I have more credibility. I would say that from cursory searches of my name on Twitter, which I try not to do often, I find that credibility might not be the right word. I'm getting savaged, as a conspiracy theorist and a liar and so on and so forth. Yes, what I did in that article was quote their own words back to them. And I said, and I have said several times since, I think their coup talk, which they did, I didn't put that in their mouths. They started talking about using the military. Their plan or their preference all along was, first, let's win the election outright so we don't have to do any of this stuff. And maybe they did that. I freely admit, I don't know. Second, if we can't win it outright, let's, use the mail-in loopholes and various things to make sure that we game it in our way. Probably they did that, although I admit it, I don't know. Third was, if that doesn't get us over the line, show up, find boxes, ballots in the middle of the night and the day after. It looks like they did that. I don't know, but they're not answering questions about those things, right? And then after that, which this is the stage we have not gotten to, it's like, well, if that doesn't work, fill the streets. And then stage five, last ditch is, I'll bring in the military. Hasn't gotten to that either. Although I think they're thinking about it because their view is probably that if Trump doesn't concede, he's illegitimate. We're going to have to drag him out of there. I don't know. We're somewhere around stage three right now. So I see all of these irregularities in the vote and I go, explain this. And I've had several conversations with, normie non-Trumpist or anti-Trumpist types who are people I've had long relationships with and I trust. And they don't believe there's fraud. I think legitimately, I mean, that is to say, not that they're right, but they genuinely believe there was no fraud, but they can't explain the irregularities. And I said, well, all right, look, I admit you guys have the power. And if you want to ram this through without explaining anything, I think you can do it. But you have to realize that people like me and many, many, many others are going to say, you cheated and you got away with it. And their view is either somewhere between not caring and just saying, well, you're crazy. I go, all right, maybe I am crazy, but do you want to govern a country where 70 million people you think are insane? And maybe you made them insane because you refused to explain something that you could otherwise explain? I've yet to hear a good answer for that.
They don't have one. And I have some lefty friends too. It's a diminishing circle for me over the last decade. And I was never a lefty, but I always had a few from law school and from doctoral studies. But that group is dwindling, and that group is also thinning in the proverbial follicular area of good arguments that square or even look like they have a chance at squaring with recto ratio. Here's what I mean. Look, there's only two reasons you can be as wrong as the left is on the election, on abortion, on whatever. Take your pick. It's you're either stupid or you're evil. And, you know, the conservatives get into all kinds of hand-wringing.
Choice three, which is crazy. You're crazy.
Oh, crazy. Yeah. Outright crazy. That's it. But outright crazy is a higher bar than stupid or evil. But I agree with you. I had a comedian on this show, and he said there has to be a third. I said, I don't know. It was Ann Coulter's favorite comedian. He came on with me, and he was like, there's got to be a third. Here's my point. There are 370 pages of sworn affidavits from that one county in Michigan alone that there's outright electoral fraud happening. I haven't looked at all the sworn affidavits, Michael, but I mean, that's a lot for one county. And there's good reason to believe there's evidence that this is happening in counties all over Michigan and all over 30 states, at least the battleground states, which are all part of those 30 states, which use the same techniques of cheating. So if you're going to give your friends the benefit of the doubt, which is a good thing to do, they have to be able to square the next phase of the lie, specifically where we are at today, you know, on Thursday, Friday, late week, you know, 2 weeks after the election, coming up to 2 weeks after the election. Here's where we're at. The New York Times and all the media outlets are lying very specifically about the fact that there is no evidence. There is tons of evidence. I'm a lawyer. This is just tons of
evidence. Right. I'm so sick of hearing that there's no evidence, right? I admit that evidence is not proof. Evidence can be misleading. Evidence can be explainable. Evidence can be irrelevant, after inspection and so on. I get all of that. Stop shouting in my face that there's no evidence. Explain to me why the evidence isn't real or doesn't matter or is explainable in some other way. They won't do that. They're just saying, he's the president-elect. Shut up, you crazy conspiracy theorist. Or worse, you are an enemy of democracy. That is all I'm hearing. It's just a pure propaganda power play. It's just it's an onslaught. It's, you know, they want to rule by, in a way, it's by force. It's a kind of soft force. I don't think they're going to actually take to the streets and like beat people if they protest, but it's brute force propaganda, if you will. It's sort of like to coin an inherently contradictory phrase. It's soft force,
soft
force, right? They're not going to hit you with a club, but they want to force this meme through. By will, just you will believe. It reminds me of Prince Six, Machiavelli's Prince, where he says, you know, all armed prophets were successful and the unarmed ones were ruined. Why were the armed ones successful? He says, because they had the means to make somebody believe. And when they stopped believing, they had the means to make you believe by force. That's what they're trying to do now. You will believe this was legitimate and we are going to shove it down your throat. And the force that they have, again, it's not a baton, but is we will censor anybody who raises doubt. So you're going to get kicked off social media platforms. You're going to be attacked, delegitimized, and called a conspiracy theorist, to which I can say, okay, fine, I'm not on social media. Me personally, like, you can't kick me off Facebook or Twitter because I'm not on them. You can stop me from saying X or Y or Z. I agree. Yeah, you got the power, But here's the thing. You can't make me believe. You can't make me believe. You can only control what I can say in public. You cannot make me believe something that you haven't truly convinced me of, nor can you do that to 70 million other people. I think they can get, I hate to say this, I think it's plausible that they can get away with this because they have so much power. They can't make people believe. They can only persuade. And then right now I see no attempt to persuade.
Agreed. There's absolutely none. I was interviewed by an internet news program yesterday, and I was going up against some Democratic strategist on the other side. And the way the question was framed, I thought it was alternate news. I thought they'd be a bit friendlier to me, was clearly overwrought in a sense that the intent was to deceive. And it was, oh, I was like, oh, this is how this is going to go. It was like, hey, there's no evidence, and why would anybody believe that Trump could still be president? And I was like, oh, well, I have to back up like four steps before I begin to answer the question the way I thought it would be framed. And I have to do it in real time. Well, there are mountains of evidence, mountains of compelling evidence. I mean, no bit of evidence is ipso facto dispositive proof. Yeah. But except there's tons that is very, very compelling. And there's in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, that it's enough by standard measures to overturn. And in all these other states like Arizona and Georgia, well, it's not even going to come to the electoral process. He's set to win. And those states just froze their counts for no reason. Even Alaska did this. Like they needed four extra little electoral votes. They just freeze their votes and wouldn't continue without explanation, wouldn't continue a week, 8 days, 9 days afterwards to resume the count. This all goes together in a way that in your original article, Michael, The Coming Coup, I'd overlooked that one or two paragraphs all the times I'd read it. I was like, you seem to have called what they did in the event of a close race. I don't think it was close. What do you think of this? What I've been saying is, here's Red Mirage. Red Mirage, together with the mail-in votes that would be heightened this time, plays a unique role. Red Mirage, if you know you're going to get actually beaten, I think they're going to get beaten decisively without the electoral fraud. That's my theory. Red Mirage means I'm bowling against you. You're a better bowler than me. I know I'm going to get whooped just from at the start, at the end, whatever. So I'm going to cheat. I'm going to pause in the middle. This isn't that complicated. I tell you and everyone watching the bowling match, hey, Michael's going to get way up in bowling. You know, there's a reason for it. There's a good reason for it. The good reason might not actually be so good. But everything's going to change after we take our little beer break at frame six or whatever. So you get up the way you would have gotten way up on me because I'm a crappy bowler. We go take a beer pause, and then I insert software that's shaving points my direction. And I take just enough of a lead at the end because it had been mathematically tabulated to get ahead in just the little five frames that I needed, just the five or six states that I needed. Then I can say, look, I'm a genius. I called it out. I called this Red Mirage. And if I'm willing to cheat, there's really nothing to stop me. Now, all I did was anytime you're bad at something and you're in a contest, if you could take a pause and you're basically, you have the wherewithal to cheat, you can call it out and you call it Red Mirage and make up some other reason, mail-in ballots. That's not compelling. That's not compelling at all. And it didn't compel any of us when we went to bed at 3, woke up in an hour and a half and saw that they'd swung all of these important states all when they thought people would be most asleep. That's really, to me, it's really convincing. So, what do we do with the media apparatus if that Red Mirage theory of mine is true, or if anything like it is true? How do we reverse the script on them? I think there's hope. I think there's real hope.
Well, I'm always pessimistic, so my only caution on the hope point is that they have the power. They have all the institutions. It's clear that every powerful institution in America, public and private, wants Joe Biden to be president. It does not want Donald Trump to be president. And when you're up against that level of power, it's very hard to reverse it. Now let's back up and say, I admit again, because I know I'm going to be savaged for the 15 millionth time, as a conspiracy theorist, I don't know what happened. All I would say to those people who control these processes is, if you want me to believe that Joe Biden won legitimately, which I'm willing to believe, I think it's plausible, then you have to explain everything that happened. You have to allow investigations, and you have to allow people who aren't on your side to see the facts into these counting rooms and into the investigations so that they can ask questions. And you have to answer their questions legitimately. You can't just say, well, we'll do our own, the same, you know, the way the deep state or whatever you want to call it always does things like, we'll do our own investigation, and then they do something that takes a year and it's completely opaque, and they write a report after and says, well, we found no wrongdoing, therefore it's all cleared up. I mean, you can't do it like that.
Right.
You got to open the doors, let the light in, let people who aren't on your side look at it. And when they come out and say, I looked at this thoroughly and I didn't see anything wrong, or everything, every concern that I had was explainable, I personally will say, all right, yeah. I just don't think they're going to do that. But that's what they need to do. That's what they need to do if they want this to be legitimate. So I expect that they won't do it either. And then the question is, why won't they do it, right? Obvious answer is because they don't think that if there's sunlight, the thing will look clean. It'll look bad. Or, I mean, my own view is, if you don't have anything to hide, if this was legitimately won, then you can let anybody look at anything, and you will get away. You know, it will just affirm your belief that you won legitimately. I think they would say to the, well, why should we do that? You know, like, that's like, you know, saying, you don't have anything to hide, you should let everybody just come into ransack your house and, you know, search all of your drawers and file cabinets and your bank account, right? Then there's no privacy. This isn't about the Fourth Amendment, you know, right to privacy or anything like that. This is all about the sanctity of our election system. They should welcome a fair investigation so that people believe this thing worked. So if they thought they won, I think they would do that. Maybe they think they won and they don't want to do it, partly because they're, you know, who knows? It's embarrassing because, well, they know the system. Maybe they think that they know the system is unclean, but it didn't do it this time, but they want to preserve its ability to do it later. I don't know. All I know is they don't want any kind of investigation right now. They just want to ram this thing through, close it out, force Trump to concede, force everyone to bend the knee and say Biden won the election legitimately. I think they have the power to ram that outcome through. I really do. I just don't think they have the power to force 70 million people to believe it was all legitimate, to really believe in their hearts.
Okay, so two things. One, I want to respond with, like, look, I'm very convinced that Arizona and Georgia are going to flip. Pennsylvania has tons and tons of evidence that can come out procedurally, judicially. And then Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin have a lot of evidence that could come out judicially too. But at least two or three of these states are going to flip for Trump before we even go to judicial proceedings. CNN took a couple of the states off of the win for Biden map. So given that, a question for you. My question is, what will happen if what I think is going to play out plays out? What will they do if the votes shift on the electoral board before we send electors at all of the 50 states in middle December, either judicially or just procedurally? What then? The world media apparatus and all of the basically institutions of power in the West, like you said, are for Biden. How will they keep the red mirage talk going? How will they keep the color revolution going? Assuming that the Electoral College flips for Trump, you and I might be less skeptical. Look,
that's a multi-part question, because if it's just a state or two that doesn't change the ultimate outcome, I would expect them to say, yeah, well, I mean, they would have to denounce the legitimacy of the flip to preserve their own credibility and so on, and because it might point in a direction they don't want it to go. But I would also expect them to say, this doesn't change. You know, we've already seen this happen a little bit. Like, well, of course, first it was there's no fraud. Now we're hearing around the margins, well, of course, there was some fraud. There's always some fraud, but it's so little that it doesn't change the outcome. So let's say Trump does flip a state or two. They'll be like, well, maybe, but doesn't change the outcome. I think their argument will be twofold. This, we don't think this is real. This is fake. And even if it's real, it doesn't change the outcome. And then stage three is, wow, if this keeps going, if another domino falls, this could be very bad for us. That's why they're going to have to attack the legitimacy while denying the significance at the same time and keep fighting. So I don't know. I mean, so far, what? It changes from day to day and hour to hour. I mean, where are we in terms of certification? Like, where are we in terms of the Electoral College vote count? I don't know. All I know is on Saturday, the media was saying Joe Biden is the president-elect, hammered down, it's over. Well, that's not the case until states start certifying and the other guy concedes. The reason why Trump was accepted as the president-elect on Wednesday in 2016 is because it was very clear from the vote tallies and there weren't all of these questions in various states that he won the Electoral College decisively. That's not clear of Joe Biden now, even though as far when I checked yesterday, he has a 5 million popular vote count lead. Whether that's real or not, I also don't know. But, you know, we have to have these counts. Georgia says they're going to do an audit. You know, all of this stuff is still up in the air. And this rush to say it's done, it's over, accept it, is just part of a propaganda push, as far as I can tell. Even if they're right in the end, you know, you can be what it's possible to be prematurely right. In other words, you know, I'll use an analogy. If a referee were to call a football game in the middle of the third quarter and say, it's over, you know, Madison High School won. And the other team was like, well, we're behind 30-0, but there's still the rest of the game to play. They would be right. And if at the end, it's still 30-0 and the other team won, their coach would be right to say, you still called it too early, right? That's not your call to make until it's truly over. That's what they're trying to do now. Even if they turn out to be right, they're still trying to call it before it's really over.
Right. But it means something. And then now I want to talk about the two types of evidence that both count in a courtroom, that count according to Recto Ratio and account in a courtroom. There's subjective and there's objective. Subjective is we look at the behaviors following upon a crime or an actus reus committed by the person. Did you flee from the scene? Did you flee from the cops? Were you hiding red blood-stained hands? They've followed upon all of the subjective acts, like having pizza boxes taped over Michigan counting room windows, like in Pennsylvania, outright disobeying the order of a Supreme Court justice, Silent Sam Alito, who told them you have to let them in. Then you switch over to the objective evidence, and there's all kinds of objective evidence which surveys the whole scene, the crime and the behavior after the crime, that corresponds with it really tightly. In Pennsylvania, we have recordings of the training sessions where they're joking about, like, don't worry, they're not going to be able to get any closer than 6 feet to you to see what you're doing. We have that. We have tons and tons of sworn affidavits. We have the voting machines, Dominion and like Hammer and Shadow, all these ominous sounding names. So the subjective crime scene and after the way it played out and the objective status of the election and the way that the fraudulent election seems to have played out, they correspond really tightly. And in every single case, they combined to give Joe Biden an advantage. Not one of these cases. Did they give Trump the advantage. I mean, come on, man. That's like 20 out of 20, 25 out of 25. Yeah. What do your friends say about that? Just be like, how many times can you flip a coin?
No, I know exactly what they say, which is it's a conspiracy and you're a conspiracy theorist and this didn't happen. Or if it did happen, it has an explanation. I'm just not going to give you the explanation because you don't deserve an explanation. I mean, that's really all it is. It's you're crazy. You don't deserve an explanation. Shut up. That's the answer, right? I'd like to hear the answer. I'd actually like to believe this was a fair election.
And yet,
if Joe Biden won, I'd be disappointed for obvious reasons. I liked Trump's policies. I want a border wall. I want better trade deals. I want all the things Trump was going to give us. I don't want the things that the Biden-Harris administration is going to give us, right? So I'd be disappointed. I'd be more than disappointed. I'd be upset if he lost legitimately, because I would say to myself, this is sad. American people voted for something that I think is ultimately not in their interests, and this will harm us. But I could accept it if I thought it was real. And I'm willing to think it was real. In a sense, I'm more black-pilled than a lot of people because I think it's highly plausible that the American people, circa 2020, the way they are constituted, would vote for a bunch of things that I think are bad for America and that I don't want. Right. I'm not in the position that like the only way we lost is because it was stolen. I don't believe that. I think we could have absolutely lost completely legitimately. But I want to hear explanations for all this stuff and I'm not hearing it. I don't expect to hear it. That's just not the mood that the media and that all of these types are in. They're just in shut up, go away. You're bad mode.
I'm there with you on the black pilling. I agree. Before election night, I was like, I think Trump will win, but I'm so blackpilled on the state of the cultura that a bunch of these people could want socialism, which they're going to get with a Harris-Biden ticket. Gotcha. But once I started seeing your predictions play out that night, Michael, and then especially after that night, I thought, I started begging to differ with you. There is no way plausibly Biden won. Once I'm seeing that, particularly the subjective behavior of the party opponent, the defendant, right? There's no way that the behaviors are completely convincing. Why would they be in shut up mode if they had a plausible case for winning? I'm asking you non-rhetorically.
I don't know. I want the answer to that too, right? I think that's a fair question. Why be in shut up mode if you really won? Let the sunlight in. Let everybody look. Let Republicans look. Let state officials look. Let Trump campaign officials look. Let everybody look, and then come back and tell me I'm crazy and this didn't happen. And if people who I think are credible look at real evidence and tell me I'm crazy and that this didn't happen, I will accept it and I will go away. More than that, I will write about it and say, "Hey, Trumpists, we legitimately lost." That just demonstrates the depth of the hole that we're in or the crisis that we're in. I think our agenda is still the right one for the country and we're going to have to fight for it. But look, we really lost a real election and, we have to go forward based on the truth. If these people could convince me, if they made the attempt, which I don't expect them to make, that we legitimately lost, I actually would rather know that information than not know it so that I could tell whatever audience I have, this is what we're facing. We are facing a real loss in 2020 after one term. And if we still believe in this agenda, which I do, look at what we have to do to enact it. It's going to be a real serious uphill climb. I want to know that for real. And I want to tell people, whoever listens to me, I want them to know it too, so that we know what we're facing.
Agreed. I don't disagree with what you just said, for the record. I'm just apprising. I'm taking note in a lawyerly way or whatever, of the evidence that's really out there right now. I don't get to look at all of the sworn affidavits, but I've seen some of them. I've seen video of the Democrat poll workers that are like, this is unjust. I was being bullied just for standing up and saying, you guys are cheating. They're swearing out affidavits. Faulty witnesses do not do that all over a county or all over a state or a country. And that's what's happening right now. So I don't think rushing to the conclusion. I am gracing to the conclusion that, okay, this is legit, the case against the mathematical count right now of the Electoral College. So I do agree. If they could convince me, and they're not going to try, and they'd have to try really hard because the evidence is out there right now, then I would accept a loss and say, what do I do given my black-pilled state on the culture or yours? But I want to know from you what your opinion is. What if it does get as far as Trump flips the Electoral College, that all of those electors before mid-December when we send them to vote? What will the media, all of the institutions of power in the West do, all the European countries, what will they do to delegitimize that? If we can convince at the very least 50 state legislatures, no, Trump won college. Where I'm thinking.
They'll have to stop it. They'll have to try to stop it somehow. It's impossible to imagine them going, well, that's our system. This is totally fair. I mean, because if he flips it, that will be kind of ipso facto proof that they cheated, right? So let's think this through. If he flips it, he will only flip it on the basis of evidence, conclusive evidence, proof, really, that he cheated, Remember, to all those who are listening to this who want to deliberately mischaracterize what I'm saying, I repeat the word if, you morons, you willful liars, if. So if he does, it could only be on the basis of conclusive proof that they cheated, but then you have to say, well, if they already cheated the first time, what's to make them go, well, gosh, golly, this is legitimate and constitutional, let's accept it now. I think they're going to do whatever they have to do to keep him out. I mean, they're not going to take this lying down. I mean, that if that's the case, then it's part of the op, in the sense that the idea was, well, we get Biden in there, you know, by any means necessary, so that it looks like it's his. And then if Trump flips it, it'll look like Trump is taking it from Biden. And so Trump is responsible for the coup. Therefore, he's the villain. Therefore, any means necessary to take it back from the villain are justified. Once again, to all of the willful misinterpreters, if I don't expect this to actually happen. I don't even know if it was stolen from him in the first place. Although I want to say to all the concern trolls out there and you know, various haters, the reason I don't know is because you won't explain it. It's because all you are saying, and every apparatus of power that you control, which is all of them, is just saying, shut up, conspiracy theorist, anti-democracy person. You know, we refuse to explain it. Well, okay, if you're going to keep that pose up, keep in mind that I'm never going to believe what happened. I'm never going to know. You can't know either, though. All of Biden's supporters, you know, if you really want to be honest with yourself, all this bleeding over the last 4 years about our democracy and the Russians and so on, well, we're protecting the sanctity of our democracy. If all the people who believed that, or at least shouted about that over the last 4 years, and who really want Biden to win, if they have any intellectual honesty in them, have to admit that they don't really know who won the 2020 election either. We're all in the same boat. We don't know. If you're intellectually honest, you have to say you don't really know until these things are explained. And if they're not explained, none of us, if we're intellectually honest, will ever know.
In the coming coup, you said very specifically that if it's anything but a Trump landslide, Michael, then If it were a close election and Trump wins, which is, I guess, what it would be if Trump flips all this, then immediately the mainstream news outlets would take away Trump's mic. They would silence him. The, you know, social media like Twitter and Facebook would silence him. All of this has happened even when it showed a narrow defeat of Trump. Isn't that relevant?
Well, I mean, it has and it hasn't. Actually, I think my predictions, some of them were wrong. I actually thought that social would just turn him off, that as soon as the media called it for Biden, they would turn him off. And at least one friend said, nah, they won't do that. It's too brazen. They will just, you know, put warnings on it or, you know, do other things around the margins, but they won't shut him off.
Which is what they did.
That guy was right, and I was wrong. They didn't. They haven't turned him off. He's still on Twitter. He's still able to do stuff. I guess he's been, you know, suppressed to some degree, but they haven't just, what I thought they would do is just boink it, you know, pull the plug. So, hey, you know, I was wrong about that. If I'm wrong about that, I could be wrong about other stuff. So people who want to say I'm wrong, I freely admit that I called that one off. I called that one incorrectly.
The mainstream media refused to cover his first two press conferences after quote unquote defeat. That's pretty stark. That's never happened. So yes, yeah. You're right. His Twitter account is still up. But every tweet or every other tweet that he sends out comes with a warning. I mean, it's pretty close. I mean, you're splitting hairs. To me, it's unprecedented in a republic that they would be this brazen against the sitting president, even if he is the electoral one who was defeated. And also, I don't know if you caught this, but a Biden campaign manager did repeat the threat to remove him by force on January 20th. Did you catch that?
No.
I sent it out on Twitter. They said, yeah, we will not be shy to remove anyone who's still interloping on the White House. They didn't use his name. That was like 2 days after the election. Another element of this. So I think they're preserving that option, man. I think even if Trump flips the Electoral College, they're going to just use the popular will of the misinformed people. And if they can, maybe the 82nd Airborne or whatever
if they follow that order. I mean, look, there's a couple of things in play here. First of all, you have to think through various scenarios. if let's say that there are actual audits and recounts that really do flip certain states, in that case, I can see Trump trying to hang on and saying, I didn't lose. I'm not going anywhere. Okay. And then does the military follow an order to drag him out of there? Hard to say, right? I think maybe not. Probably not. Another count is he doesn't manage to do it, or he thinks he's flipped it, but the courts refuse to give it to him. He still thinks he won. But the numbers say on January 20th, he hasn't won. I think he leaves. You don't need force to get him out of there. But if that were the case, he doesn't believe he lost legitimately. Most of his supporters don't believe he lost legitimately. I think that they can get him out of there, sure. And I don't think they even need to get him out of there. I think he'll just go. What does he do after that? Do you think he just goes away and goes and says, I lost? I mean, I keep coming back to, I wrote about this a little bit, but people should think this through. Richard Nixon lived until, I think, like 19, I can't remember when he died, 93, 94. Bill Clinton was president when Richard Nixon died. So 35 years or so after the 1960 election, which he went to his grave believing he legitimately won and was stolen from him in Illinois and Texas, right? And he never made a thing out of it. He was always praised for being statesmanlike for that. Well, how statesmanlike he was to concede. But the same breath, the same people who praised him for being statesmanlike would say, but there was no fraud. Richard Nixon was statesmanlike, but there was no fraud. But of course, that's a contradictory statement in the sense that he was only statesmanlike if he thought there was fraud.
Right.
Because if he was just deluded, he wasn't statesmanlike for conceding.
Right.
He was sort of a crazy guy who believed something that wasn't true, and he conceded based on recognition of reality, right?
Right.
What they want Trump to go, what they ultimately want is they want Trump to go away and say to his followers, yeah, I lost, get over it. If he doesn't believe that, and if they don't answer all of these questions, I'm not sure he's going to do that. I think he may say to his followers, look, I don't think we lost. I'm just speculating here. I think he might say, I don't think we lost, but I don't have the power to stay in, so I'm going. But, you guys need to know what really happened here wasn't on the up and up. And our system doesn't work. And we have to have a better system for being sure that whoever apparently wins an election really deserved to win the election.
Well, he might say even one step more profoundly, our system doesn't work in general, which speaks to the black pill that you were referring to when you said, look, if 52 or 53% of Americans vote for socialism, then the res publica is done, and we need to acknowledge that.
We're drifting in a direction like that where, the Democrats are saying, certainly if they had lost, I mean, let's say November 4th, everyone woke up and Trump had clearly won again and there was no way to change the outcome, but he lost the popular vote by 5 million and he won in the Electoral College. The Democrats would be all over themselves to want to get rid of the Electoral College, which they have always been. And I got to say, Trump has said he doesn't like the Electoral College either, which I think is clearly not in his own best interests, nor is it in America's constitutional interests. But what that would do if we were to get rid of it, and I think we're probably, we're going to be going in that direction, is make America more and more of a plebiscite democracy, and more kind of a blue state where the city rules the countryside. Whoever has the most votes wins, period. Where, in Illinois, Chicago rules the rest of the state. In Maryland, Baltimore rules the rest of the state. In Virginia, the D.C. suburbs and Richmond rule everything else. What we will have is a USA where New York, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, a handful of places where you can rack up huge vote counts, and their inner ring suburbs just rule everything else. And they'll say, well, you're outvoted every time, so that's democracy. The problem will be, of course, is that you're outvoted literally every time. That the people in the hinterlands and the countryside never, ever have their concerns heard the same way this happens in blue states. And yes, that works for as long as you can keep it going. But it's inherently unstable, and one has to ask, how long could they keep that system going? I don't think they're asking that. They're just right now, to borrow from Benjamin Disraeli, they're climbing the greasy pole. They just want to get to the top. They're not thinking about how to stay there or how they can make the system just or even stable. Forget just stable. If you're the ruler, you want your rule to last, which means you don't want to make everyone below you unhappy, because a bunch of unhappy ruled people tend to be rebellious over time. They're not thinking about that at all right now. I don't know that they ever will, but if they want to stay in power, they're going to have to at some point. And I think, you know, 51% or 52 or even 55% or even 60% of the country ruling the other 40% without the other 40% ever having a say in what goes on is not a stable situation for the long term.
Wow. Well, here's my parting shot. I'll let you take us out, but here's my parting shot. You've been very instructive over the past. I didn't read your article on September the 4th. I read, I think, closer to October the 4th, and I've shared it lots, and I've reread it, and so I thank you for that. I think you've seen further than others have for whatever reason. One area where I think we might disagree, just because I know Claremont guys too. I was in their doctoral program for a short while, and I have a lot of friends from Claremont Graduate School. I'm not a Straussian. I don't have the same fixation with the union, right? I'm a balkanization guy. So in that sense, I'm at least half a step further on the black pill. I'm not a big Lincoln guy. I'm not a big union guy. You know, I'm Jefferson, 1801, wrote from a position of power that American happiness does not depend upon union. American, whether it's 13 separate countries or four, the way guys like George Mason and Patrick Henry wanted, or one, it's still America, and there's still possibility for a League of Friendship. I believe in classic Montesquieuan republics, which are about the size of, I don't know, Virginia, not a continent, which is
if my recollection is correct, Aristotle says that about the ideal size for a Republican government is 120,000 citizens.
Yep. Yeah. Right? Yeah. 100,000. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. Yeah. I mean, come on, 300 million is a joke. So I'm just kind of like, I'm not.
The founders had to face this in the early, I love my favorite part of the, everybody reads on the Federalist for when it goes into the specific workings of the various branches for insight on the government, which I get, and I totally support that. But my favorite chapters are the early chapters. When they're making this philosophic case, and one of the early things that they say is, "Hey, they have to address this point. First of all, they have to address two points, really. One is, why are we setting this up as a republic at all when republicanism is a discredited idea? Even in the ancient, first of all, it hasn't been. You know, the only place you see it around today is like, you know, Renaissance Italy, where it was a joke. It just barely operated. And if you look back far enough, you have to go all the way back to the ancient world where it also had all these problems. So why are we doing this? And then point question two was, even if we think it's the right thing, can we do it in a country so large, right? Not merely large territorially, but large population-wise. They have to answer these questions. And they freely admit that, you know, according to the theory and practice, the answer should be no, this is a bad idea. But we think we've found a new way to do it, and this is why we're going to set it up as a republic. In a sense, you're on good ground because you're with these critics who are asking the questions in 1787. Why are we setting up the government like this? They're legitimate questions.
I mean, in Madison, right, like Madison and Federalist 10, 39, 51, the famous ones. My irritation when I was in classes at Claremont, which is a great institution, was just, okay, let's read. This is a back and forth. Dialectic discussion with the anti-federalists who were responding. They're responding in really compelling ways, particularly the writings of Brutus and Cato. Brutus's 4th, 5th, and 6th letters respond so devastatingly to Federalist 10 and 39 that it's like
my school. That is to say, not the institution, which is corrupt, but the people who taught there and taught you and I, hey, they assigned all that stuff. So you can say you're splitting from the Claremont School, but if you hadn't gone there, you wouldn't have read the Anti-Federalists. Give them some credit.
Yeah. I read them because I was looking for a response to this. I think republics work. They tend to be long-lasting. They just can't be big, like Montesquieu said. And the Anti-Federalists were screaming this from a rooftop. You guys... You know, Madison, who is a famous waffler, his dying words were, it's just a change of mind, my dear. He's a famous waffler. He's a small government guy and, you know, with his Virginian friends in the early 1780s. And he becomes a big government guy in the late 1780s. And he's a small government guy again in the 1790s. He keeps pitching
both of us,
Montesquieu.
Of course, we happily accept big government circa 1780
sure,
compared to big government circa 2020.
You got me there, dude. I'll take federalist style big government. Because it's not big government.
Right.
But I always tell my students, this will be my true last statement, on a whiteboard in my classroom that's 20 feet long, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, yes, the Anti-Federalists were more conservative insofar as they were slightly smaller government, but they were like this. There's like a hair's breadth separating them. Today's left and today's right are on opposite ends of that 20-foot, two-scale whiteboard. So, yes, I'll take Federalist rule any day over.
I mean, look, we make this too much of a history lesson. Maybe your listeners get bored, but the big argument, which we haven't mentioned, but I will now mention, was about the threat of foreign intervention, right? That's what drove the case for union, not exclusively, but more than any other issue. It's that if we're divided, these European empires, which still have a massive presence on the North American continent, will be much better able to pick us off one by one. We need to stay together to protect our interests and defend ourselves from foreign influence. That's that's kind of the macro case that the Federalist Papers, that Hamilton, Madison, and Jay make for the Union. They don't dismiss the concern that consolidation of power will, or at least threatens to endanger liberty. They don't dismiss that. And this is, by the way, is one of the reasons why we have a Bill of Rights, right? The Bill of Rights does not come out of the Constitutional Convention. The Constitutional Convention gives us the Constitution and with the articles only. The price of getting it ratified was the Bill of Rights. And that was a concession that the Anti-Federalists squeezed out of the Federalists who wanted the Constitution. In other words, the Federalists won the argument essentially based on this notion that we ought to stay together because there's a foreign threat. And if we're not united, the foreign threat will be more dangerous. And the Anti-Federalists said, okay, we still don't like it, but if we're going to ratify it, then we want all of this stuff codified, clearly written down. You know, it's one thing to enumerate powers about what you can do. We want a bunch of stuff that says explicitly what you can't do.
Right.
And they, all right, if that's the price of ratification, they went along with it. So, yeah, you're right. They're way closer. Now, I only point this out as to say to the readers, right, well, what's that case for foreign intervention on the North American continent? I ask this as a question. Some people say to me all the time, oh, you know, the Chinese are, they're, you know, one step away from like invading California. And I go, I doubt it. I mean, I kind of, I wonder how well that would go if they tried it. But that sounds kind of crazy to me. But in any event, it seems to me that the case for union based on the danger of foreign intervention, which was felt very keenly in 1787, I wonder if it has the same salience in 2020.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people need to remember at the Virginia, the Richmond Ratification Convention, which was like June 3rd to June 24th, 1788, the final vote on prior ratification of the Bill of Rights, prior to ratifying the Constitution, was very close. It was like 89 to 80. I went through with Michael Rappaport, my legal mentor, every line of the debates. Where they were, this is where I learned so much from listening to these guys. The Anti-Federalists, most of the famous Virginians were Anti-Federalists who were kind of calling Edmund Pendleton and James Madison turncoats because they'd previously been with them against the new Constitution in favor of the Articles of Confederation, which had an answer, right? It was a league of friendship of 13 sovereign states that were doing treaty government, essentially, under the principles of foreign international immunity. And that Congress is a treaty gov term. Federal, FOTUS, is a treaty gov term, meaning you're 13 separate countries. You're going to come together to defend yourselves, though.
Right. No, it's exactly what Machiavelli describes in Discourses, Book 2, Chapter 4. He calls it the Tuscan League, or a defensive league. And in fact, he even uses the number. I don't know if this is historical coincidence, providence, or there's some meta meaning that I've never figured out. But he says, you know, at most they are 12 or 14. Well, what's between 12 and 14? I don't know. There's an integer in there. There's a whole number in there. So, oh, wait, 13, right? We had exactly 13. Like, it's almost exactly what he described, coming together to form a defensive league, which was, of course, the Anti-Federalist answer to the question that I asked earlier, was how do we prevent European empires or foreign powers from coming around to this continent, which we have not yet secured, and picking us off one by one. And some of them said, well, we could still be sovereign and independent, but form a defensive league, right? And in the end, as I say, they lost the argument. I don't mean that in a metaphysical sense, like they were disproved. Lost the argument in the sense that the other side won. The other side convinced more people, the Constitution was ratified, and we got the government that we got. But yeah, it's totally fair and reasonable to bring this up as a concern, because it was a concern at the time, without question.
It's a concern at the time now, but you're right, man. And I really thank you for all your great work. And I steer my viewers to the work of Michael Anton, working with Claremont Review of Books, American Mind. Just you're doing good work. And God be with us in these times. It's truly frightening. I'm going to be out at I'm leaving tonight. This will probably air after I'm already there, but I'm going to the Washington, D.C. Stop the Steal rally. I led the Baton Rouge one last Saturday. So I'm in doctoral work. So I am really stretched in these crazy lean times to, get Trump what I think is his rightly won win. And
I will be slightly more circumspect than you and just say, or to repeat, because I got a lot of people after me. I don't know if he won. I honestly don't know. But I want to know. And if everything keeps going the way it's going, I won't know, because they're just not going to tell me. They're going to say, shut up. All doubts are illegitimate and you're a conspiracy theorist and you hate our democracy. I mean, the same people, think about this. I mean, if I can use slightly coarse language, the same people who gave this administration a proctology exam over a complete farcical allegation that Trump was literally an asset of Vladimir Putin. One, no questions answered, no investigation whatsoever at all into all this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that right there should raise red flags for any normal person. Like, really? We went through 2 years of a special counsel that interviewed, 110 people, some of them multiple times. I don't even know the numbers. I used to know them because I would research them and then put them into articles and then, promptly forget because of age or whatever. But they spent a lot of money. They hired a lot of people. They interviewed a million people. They spent 2 years. Then they impeached him. All of this turns up absolutely nothing. It's farcical. But no, those same people who are totally sure and told you must believe Trump is in the pocket of the Russians now tell you must believe that this election was totally on the up and up and anything you see that's irregular is wrong and we're not going to look into it whatsoever.
And that Biden's not in the pocket of the Chinese.
Right.
Even though there's
or the Ukrainians for that matter, right? I mean, same people who said, we will not cover evidence that Hunter Biden was on the take. I mean, before even the laptop, I'm not dismissing anything found in the laptop, but I didn't need the laptop. When the impeachment thing came up, I looked at it and here's what I saw. The guy got hired for something like $85,000 a month. He had he doesn't speak the language. He doesn't know the country. He didn't even visit the country. And he doesn't understand the natural gas or the hydrocarbon industry. And he's put on the board of a state-owned enterprise and was paid something like $3.5 million over X, 2.5 years or whatever it was. I knew immediately what that was. That's a pay-for-play scam. Of course. That's why you hired him. You hired him because of who he's connected to. Everybody knows. No evidence. No, the payment without experience is the evidence.
Prima facie.
No one has ever hired me for anything in my life to do nothing on an issue I don't know about. Precisely because I don't have a connection to somebody that they can, right? When every time I've ever been hired, they're like, we're going to pay you the market rate and this is what you have to deliver, right?
Right.
When you see these kinds of things happen, you know why it's happening. And then when they just megaphone, bullhorn in your face, there's nothing there, pay no attention. You just know I'm being lied to.
Right.
So this kinds of things, they work as long as they work. This is a sort of white pill and sort of half black pill thought. People say, by 1980, everybody in the Soviet Union knew that everything the system was telling them was a lie. All right, that's kind of white pill. Like eventually people catch on and they don't believe anymore. And then, the system crashes. On the other hand, the black pill is they kept that system going for 70 years.
Right.
How long can they keep this one going? I don't know. But
well, on that note,
it does accelerate its decline.
Yeah.
When they lie brazenly and nobody believes it, it does accelerate the decline.
Yeah. Well, if you can, people, join me in the Stop the Steal rally. It's not a small one. It's the national one this Saturday at noon, Liberty Plaza, D.C. I'm RVing out there with my family, and we need to do what we can to make sure that the true winner of the election emerges, whoever that is. Please subscribe to this channel, like it, hit the bell, and see to the Patreon page if you haven't seen that yet, or just go to timothyjgordon.com. Read Michael Anton's great work at American Mind and Claremont Review of Books. And he has a new book out. You want to go out on that? Your new book looks really, really relevant.
Yeah, you should read the new book. Everyone should. It's not short, but I think it does have some explanatory power, as I like to phrase it, over what's going on right now. I do.
What's it called again?
Oh, sorry. The Stakes, America at the Point of No Return, written before the election.
Yeah.
So I was actually talking to the publisher over the last couple of days, saying, like, you know, maybe we need to do a revised edition if this turns out the way I think it's going to turn out. And I think they're going to do that, but it'll be paperback and it won't be out until the fall. And I haven't started it. And it won't be vastly different, but it will be somewhat different, because the book is, you know, written last year. It was 2020 election was still in our future. Didn't know what was going to happen. Whenever the paperback comes out in the fall, whatever is going to happen will have happened. Whatever the outcome, we will know. And then the book will, whatever I do as a revision will take all of that into account.
Yeah. Great. All right. Well, God bless, man. And everyone, see me here. We're going to get back to some papal news, which is still bad news. Everything seems to be bad news, but we will have some more shows than just one on the McCarrick Report next week. We had one this week, and we're going to follow up on that. But we had to do some serious election muckraking this week. God bless everyone. Thanks a million, Mr. Michael Anton.